from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Novelist Amy Tan has made a hugely successful career writing about bridges and spaces between America and China, mother and daughter, between love and necessity. From Joy Luck Club to her latest, The Valley of Amazement, readers have read a thousand untold stories about identity and history. This time, Tan takes us to the courtesan houses of old Shanghai and beyond. This hour on Point, Amy Tan and The Valley of Amazement. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you found dynamics of your history, your immigrant experience, your family in Amy Tan's novels? Are you ready for more? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York, taking a little time out from a whirlwind book tour, is novelist Amy Tan. Her first book, The Joy Luck Club, has been translated into 35 languages, made into a movie. Her books, The Kitchen God's Wife, The Bonesetter's Daughter, and more, have delved into cross-cultural identity here and in China. Her new book is The Valley of Amazement. You'll find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Amy Tan, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Good to be back.
You could write about, I suppose, any story in any setting in the world. What took you to a high-class courtesan house as a setting in Shanghai?
Well, there's a photo of my grandmother that sits on my desk, and it's always been my inspiration. And one day I was doing some research about Shanghai, and I bought a book, and I was looking through, and suddenly I saw a photo that stopped my heart. There were 10 women, and it was called The 10 Beauties of Shanghai. Five of them were wearing clothes identical to what my grandmother was wearing in that beloved picture. They were courtesans.
And from there, did you know this world? Did you know this history?
Did you think your grandmother
was a courtesan? Was she?
No, my grandmother was revered for being an old-fashioned traditional woman who was very quiet, a victim of society. And seeing this, I was shuffling through my mind about all the possibilities. Why would she be wearing these clothes? Was it a fashion then? I continued to read, and I found out the clothes were specific to courtesans. There was a headband that had pearls, little pearls, embroidery, and it formed a V at the top of the head. It was very tight, I think, to pull the eyes up at the corners, and the jacket was very tight. The sleeves were tighter than normal, and there was white lining showing. There were matching bracelets, tight trousers, and as I continue to read, the most telling feature was that it was taken in a Western photo studio with pots of flowers, which was a symbol of the profession, the flowers.
The twist in this story, I guess there are many twists, but right off the bat, you have the fact that the madam of this house of courtesans in Shanghai, which, of course, yes, it's about ritual and all kinds of exotic interaction with men around flirtation and all the rest. It's also about sex. The madam is American. She has a daughter here who speaks right from the beginning of the book, who says, "When I was seven," this is Violet, the young daughter, "when I was seven, I knew exactly who I was, a thoroughly American girl in race, manners, and speech, whose mother, Lulu Minturn, was the only white woman who owned a first-class courtesan house in Shanghai." How does it turn out that an American woman owns a courtesan house in Shanghai, even in this period, I guess is the first decade of the 20th century?
Yeah, there were white women in Shanghai at the
sure.
time who ran bordellos or, these boats off the side out in the harbor, and they were the prostitutes. But in this story, I wanted to also capture what was going on in Shanghai during that period, which is the explosive growth of foreign trade and people scrambling to get connections, the Chinese side and then the Westerners pairing together. And also, in looking at the question of identity, I wanted to have this character have an American side to her and have this bravado that she knew exactly who she was, and she didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And she admits to this ambiguity about who she was throughout and then reaches a point where she questions who she is based purely on race. And I think that this was such an issue in Shanghai during that time. There was a separation of the races then, even though they did business together, even though they lived side by side in the international settlement of Shanghai.
When I was very young, I was friends with an older woman who had grown up in Shanghai, the early 20th century, 20s on into the 30s, and she describes these scenes that you know well and describe here, but I think a lot of people have trouble imagining just how international, just how sophisticated. She talks about dance halls there that had glass floors with lights underneath flashing like a you know, an American disco circa 1980.
Yeah.
And this was in the 20s and 30s in Shanghai. I mean, this was an incredible place.
Right. It was, you know, there were so many people from around the world, the Westerners, the British, the Americans, Australians, the Canadians, and also the Germans, the Japanese, and especially the Japanese. That population continued to grow faster than any other, and of course had serious consequences later leading up to World War II. But it was, everybody was there trying to do business, trying to take over companies and get their foothold in there. I think that the population went from sleepy village in 1850s to a million by, you know, 1910, and thereafter it just continued to grow.
You know, ever since the Joy Luck Club, you've written plenty about ambiguity of identity, especially sort of across the Pacific, but by and large, you've done it within the Chinese community. There's been no shortage of issues of ambiguity about identity right there. What brought you to bring this sort of race mixing into this story, right at the heart of it?
Well, that is my ambiguity. I'm American, and I'm also Chinese. Obviously.
But you've introduced, you say, race to it this time in a different way, which is something
race,
different than just immigration.
Right. Race, you know, during a certain period and looking at my family's identity and how I became very Western just by upbringing, but not by race. So there was also a sense when I was growing up, this self-hatred, you know, because I was not of another race. And there were also very big differences in opportunities for women during that turn of the century, the early 20th century. So I, you know, was curious to know what might have been the situation that my grandmother faced versus other people. You know, this American, very American sensibility that we have, looking at a world from long ago, you know, that included this American element in it.
There's so much in this story, in this setting that I want to unpack, but you bring up right there self-hatred in your own youth as a Chinese-American girl. We can't keep the present tense out of this story. China has become so dynamic and such a big global story. Is that kind of racial self-hatred that you point to right there, is it gone? Is it diminishing as old country, China,
gone.
You know?
I think people, you know, when I was growing up, I was the only Chinese girl in some of my classes, and I was, you know, I had racial epithets thrown at me. But certainly by the time I was in college, that was completely gone. I became an activist, and I think that's one of the phases one goes through after self-hatred. And now, you know, that people ask me, how much are you American, how much are you Chinese? And I said, it's not a percentage. It's an evolving sense of self, depending on context, wherever I am. It's never static. And I find that when I go on tour, you know, sometimes I look out on the audience and I see a sea of white faces. And that's when I feel the most different. But there's not a huge difference, you know, in values or what we think about. But I'm still conscious of that.
I wonder if that self-hatred you describe from your youth as a Chinese-American girl has even been turned really on its head. I mean, I have a young friend, Asian American. She's probably, what, 13, 14? I've seen her, you know, in private between us. We've known each other all her life. She'll raise her fist and say, Asian power, you know. It's the opposite of self-hatred now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was surprised. I think there are kids like that. It depends on the communities they live in. But I've also met young children, teenagers, who have that self-hatred, including those who were adopted. They, you know, I know of a friend who has an adopted daughter who's Chinese. She will not eat Chinese food. She wants nothing to do with anything that reminds her she is different from the race of her adoptive parents.
And yet we all know the flip side of that story. Some of those same young people, often girls, who gone right back to China and flourished there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's, you know, I think the racial identity, when you look at identity itself, there's so much that is fluid. And I think those are the kids who will later go on. They'll learn Chinese. They'll, you know, be activists, just as I, you know, was when I was, by the time I was in college and with my first job. I was doing mainstreaming, writing books about ethnicity and how you work with families and with kids who have disabilities based on cultural background.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Amy Tan about her latest, A Saga of Family History, Two Cultures, and Courtesan Life in Old Shanghai. It is called The Valley of Amazement. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can join the conversation today. Are you ready to follow Amy Tan into the world of the courtesan, the sex, the ritual, the exploitation, 50 shades of tan, she's said. What's your question on how all that worked? The women, the men, the transactions. What do we reveal? What do we conceal in family history? Does immigration itself require illusion? A question raised in Amy Tan's latest book. I mean, Amy, you've written so much about Chinese Americans. In this case, in this story, Americans as well. We asked on Facebook if people see themselves, their family, in your mixed identity fiction, even though it's rooted in the sort of Chinese origin or immigration story. April says, absolutely. She writes to us on Facebook. She says, my upbringing and historical background differs, but we share struggles of ethnic and cultural identity and adaptation in foreign land. What's universal in immigration and what's is or was unique to the Chinese immigration story, Amy?
One of the things that I find has been universal is that the stories of our parents, our ancestors, don't always immigrate over those oceans. And so the generation who grow up on American shores are not really aware, and yet these warnings and this advice that is based on what has happened to the family doesn't get transmitted. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding that where is this coming from? What I've found is that when children are able to find out what the past is, they take a profound interest and they realize that it is based on elements that have actually affected their lives. And they become very proud. They want to listen to their mothers, the stories that were told.
When those stories don't immigrate along with us, are we stripped of wisdom or are we freed to be more, you know, different, better?
I think we're stripped of understanding, and that in part that lack of understanding is what gives us a sense of self-hatred or shame that we don't have to have, because the mothers are spouting advice that don't make any sense. They're not American. You just want to say that. You know, that doesn't apply to me. That may have applied to you, but it doesn't apply to me. So the kind of worry, for example, that my mother had, or her method of instilling advice and scaring me so that I would follow it, I didn't have friends whose parents used that technique. And so I really rejected everything wholesale that my mother had to say.
Until you looked more deeply, and we've all shared in that. Lots of people calling for you. Amy Tan's latest is The Valley of Amazement. Kathy's calling from Los Angeles in California. Hi, Kathy. You're on the air with Amy Tan.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Oh, it's an honor to be on with you. I love your books. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, I have to say that I'm listening, though, in astonishment. Myself, our family's Hispanic, and, you know, we've experienced many of the things that you've described, and I'm astonished to learn that Asians have experienced this as well, because in our family, we're constantly telling our children, you need to be more like the Asians. You need to study. Look at them, how successful they are. And in one generation, they're already doctors. So study. Asian friends, be like them. Uh-huh. And so it's very surprising to me to hear what you went through as a youngster.
Kathy, I appreciate your call. Amy, are you ready to wear that mantle?
No.
Hey, be more like her. Be more like them.
It's actually kind of a myth that Asians are this, you know, this, they're perfect and they are able to tell their children they become doctors. But the fact is there are a lot of troubles, you know, that we don't know about in the Asian community. It has a huge suicide rate, especially among young people. A lot of elder abuse or poverty that we don't see. We just see the successful Asians, the successful Chinese families. So you don't want to be like all of us. Unfortunately, you know, in our family, we were always compared to other Asian kids. You can be like, you know, Jimmy, if you practiced hard enough, you know, why didn't you get straight A's? The expectations were huge. And part of that had to do with what they left behind, including, in my mother's case, her daughters. Families. I hear of so many families who have left one member of the family behind, a child, a mother, a husband, a wife. And that's not known. That was not known to me until I was in my teens.
In your new book, The Valley of Amazement, there is a daughter left behind, but it's a whole new dynamic. She's half Chinese, half American. She's left behind in a courtesan house. Not a brothel exactly, but not exactly entirely different either, though lots of ritual mm-hmm. around in Shanghai. Help us understand that bit of the story, how you've got this sexually adventurous young American woman who ends up running a courtesan house in Shanghai. How does that happen in your story, Amy?
Well, she has come to Shanghai following a lover and arrives thinking that her American ingenuity can change what has been the fate of her lover, which is to marry a girl chosen for him and to follow 9 generations of family
tradition. He's Chinese. His bride will be
Chinese,
but she's trying to turn that around.
Yeah. He seemed very modern when he was in San Francisco, and now he's returned, and he's become, in her mind, suddenly Chinese. She cannot change him. It's the difference between destiny and fate. Destiny, you make the choices. You plow ahead on that down that road. Fate, that is assigned, and you cannot fight against that in many cases.
And so, his family is having none of her as a daughter-in-law.
No. I did read about one case in which an American girl married into a scholar family, and she was beaten to death. And the thought was that, well, she deserved it. She was probably doing something, you know, that enraged the mother-in-law. And it was the Chinese law that applied to her. So it was not considered a crime, again, you know, that was, the family wasn't faulted for that.
But there's a child on the way, the daughter, Violet, the daughter of this painter who she will not be able to marry. She runs the courtesan house. Violet grows up there, seeing a lot of things that most girls do not see growing up, but doesn't expect to become a courtesan herself. She, too, gets left behind.
Yeah, and she's always looked down upon Chinese people. I mean, she grows up with them as though they're sisters, and yet she wants this separation. She enters into that world unwillingly, being kidnapped, which was the way a lot of girls entered into that world. She struggles to keep her American identity and will not give in to the kind of expectations that are placed on the other girls.
Yeah, that's pretty darn hard to keep up. There's a long section in the book where one of her colleagues there, Magic Gourd, the name she goes by, introduces her, once she's been kidnapped and really has no option, into the world of the courtesan. It's a lot about ritual. It's a lot about history and fashion and style, and a lot about sex and the interaction, it's kind of business interaction with sex at the heart of it between these young women and men. Describe some of that world to us.
Well, I wanted to emphasize the business aspect of it. It was glamorous. Certainly it was glamorous. These women created their own fashions. They would ride in carriages and young girls would faint at the sight of them. Their houses, the courtesan houses, filled with Western furniture, the most modern appliances, and yet they were also flowers with that who would wilt in a very short period of time between the ages of 15 and early 20s. The business of sex was one of negotiation. They were courted by men, and they were able to choose who would receive their intimate favors. So that was quite different from a brothel in which the man just came in and said, I'll take that one.
The house madam didn't advise them on who had the most money or direct them toward the customer with the most money?
Yeah, she had a part in it. Magic Gourd, she's actually an attendant. She used to be a courtesan, and the attendants were like the business managers of their time. They would counsel and say, you know, here you can take this person in, you know, into your boudoir, or here's what I'm going to try and do to get more money out of him. We'll go to a jewelry store and we'll play this ruse and we'll get more money out of this guy. So not all of them were dishonest like that, but there's a lot in the literature about men complaining that they were fleeced by courtesans. The handsome ones were the ones who got chosen after long courtship by several suitors.
What's the sense of sexuality that's being conveyed here? I mean, there's this whole vocabulary and tradition and, you know, there's metaphor upon metaphor in sort of Chinese, at least the literary handling of sexuality, you know, swaying bamboo shoots and tigress meets dragon.
Make those up.
Oysters in the turtle shell. This stuff is very, very detailed. And are you drawing that from actual Chinese language? Or
yes.
Is it, you're not just pulling that out of your, I think I'll call that one, bucking horse.
Those were actual positions that were in the literature. People, some nobleman's journal about the positions, he was from pillow books. And I don't even have to describe them.
You don't.
Hear the words, phoenix flying over the oyster, and you know exactly what you're talking about here. Some of that is part of the repertoire then of the courtesan to know these tricks of the trade. Now, unfortunately, the actual tricks of the trade are really unknown. The academicians that I talked to who studied, researched this area, particular area of courtesan life in Shanghai during the early 20th century, could not find anything specific about what they did behind the doors. There were allusions to it, that wives came and paid dearly to have techniques demonstrated to them so maybe their husbands wouldn't wander out every night. And it was known that some of the courtesans rose to, great popularity because of their techniques, but they were not elucidated.
As a fully mature and knowing Chinese American woman, looking back on all that, all that language and elaboration and mystique, fol-de-rol, I don't know or not. How do you look at that? Was that just a very elaborate, cage? Is there some rich cultural heritage even in all that stuff?
Well, you have to imagine these were teenage girls. So they have the same desires that any girl has. They want to fall in love. They want to belong. They want to trust. And at the same time, they had to be businesswomen. I have friends, all my friends who are Shanghainese or whose mothers are Shanghainese, we have this joke. We say we're all very lihai. Lihai in Chinese means fierce. You don't want to mess with a Shanghainese woman because she knows how to negotiate.
Deal with you.
She knows how to be persistent. And these were the qualities, I think, of women, not just courtesans but concubines. Any woman in that world somehow learned to become very clever. Very capable within their circumstances, no matter what they were.
I mean, you say lihai, you say fierce, but you know, quick as a wink, she's off at your sort of inland village of Moon Pond, and she's reduced to pretty much just a trick turner.
Yeah, well, she's married, or she thinks she is. She's become a concubine. You know, I'm always fascinated with what happens to us when our circumstances change dramatically, mm-hmm. as it did for Violet. She's been, you know, a courtesan whose career is waning, and she goes off and she thinks she's going to marry a scholar and live out in the boondocks in serenity and meditation, and she finds, no, that wasn't the truth. But this, in essence, is what happened to my grandmother. She lived in Shanghai. She had a very exciting life. Then she was, according to family lore, now I'm not sure what was the truth, but according to family lore, she was raped and forced to become the fourth wife of a rich man on an island isolated from Shanghai. Mm. She complained of boredom. I think of, you know, how would I change myself if I were thrown in a situation like that? Or thrown, you know, suddenly impoverished, suddenly in jail, whatever it is. What do we become pragmatic about? How do we change our attitude about things to survive? What do we keep within us? What would we never change?
Is that a parallel for immigration, too? Finding yourself suddenly raped and the fourth wife or concubine on an island? I mean, immigration is about as big a transformation as anybody could picture.
Well, immigration was a choice, and it came with a hope that things would be better and not worse. Of course, people often found their expectations were not that at all, and that the children, instead of being appreciative, turned against them. I think that a lot of Chinese people or a lot of immigrants became practical. They became pragmatic, and some of them just would try to hold on to what had been in their you know, former homelands. My mother and father, in raising us, did not think it was necessary for us to learn Chinese. They had the mistaken notion that learning Chinese would impair our ability to learn English. Mm. And we know today that's not true. A child can learn many languages and be equally fluent.
You describe a sister helping you with Chinese on this visit back to China for your research.
Yeah, I took her. She went to a little village with me, my older sister. She's a half-sister, one of them who was left behind mm-hmm. in China, who I met later on in my 30s. She was somebody sent down during the Cultural Revolution, worked in a rice field, told me about picking leeches off her leg every day. Mm. But we went. I'm the little sister who doesn't speak Chinese that well. And so when we're together, as we were a few days ago in Milwaukee, she speaks to me in Chinese the whole time. And she knows the level of Chinese I can speak, but that's all we speak.
Does she think it's cute or pathetic that you can't speak
Chinese? No, she's grateful. You know, mm-hmm. when I first met her, all I could say was, how are you? Mm-hmm. But I had the language within me all along, and it just came out with enough practice. It started to emerge again. Enough to say, you know, talk about gossip.
We've got a little more of this wonderful music from 1920s Shanghai right here. This is Hua Yang Din Yanhua, Seven Singing Stars. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Amy Tan. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Amy Tan about her latest novel. It is The Valley of Amazement, much of it set in courtesan life in old Shanghai. She joins us today from New York. Amy, I once flew out of Vietnam in a very strange circumstance. I was on a 747 with two passengers, myself and a very beautiful Chinese woman, middle-aged, who described how she had been poor in Vietnam during the war and had been sold to a wealthy, her virginity, that is, or herself, really, to a wealthy Chinese guy in then Saigon. She managed to escape and still had the scars from the dogs biting her as she climbed the wall, the dogs that were in the compound around the house. You have Virgin Auction, how she had listened to the woman who'd brought her to town to be a maid, you know, describe her to the man to whom she was being delivered. And she had more or less been auctioned off. You have Virgin Auction in this book. Does that still go on today in China?
Well, it goes on throughout the world. Mm. It goes on even in the United States. I was shocked to find out how many kidnappings there are of young girls who become sex slaves in the United States. But it's a huge problem throughout the world, and certainly in China. I saw on the border town, China and Burma, I saw a whole row, a block of young girls in these purported beauty parlors mm-hmm. with, you know, one hairbrush. And they looked to be about 15, and some of them had short hair, obviously had cut it to buy money, maybe for drugs, and a lot of them had AIDS. It's a big problem.
Sex slavery all over. Of course, there's different cultural tinges on that. I mean, this auction, you spend a lot of time in the book with the magic gourd preparing Violet for hers. It's all about the biggest price right there, and a lot of cultural history around that in China.
Yeah, it's well, in the book, I would, it's all business, and mm-hmm. and I would liken it to an IPO where you have to mm-hmm. have the best price, you know, from the beginning, because that's going to determine your value later on as well. It, you know, I think that some of these girls, of course, they came from families, they were sold by an uncle or a brother, kidnapped, whatever. But some of them were raised in that world. There were girls whose mothers were courtesans, and they knew that was their destiny.
And this even covered in the Shanghai Press, sort of like the Twitter IPO was covered here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were gossip columns, and you aimed to be in them as much as possible, you know, having the greatest fashion or having somebody bid on you and or, you know, somebody in your house. And so it was, you know, some of those details were quite funny, the fashion magazines, and people wanted to get in the gossip and shock people with their Western clothing touches. That was something I saw in a photo of my grandmother. If you look on the bottom, you could see the Western fringe and the shoes. And some of that was considered shocking to people who were very traditional.
When this young woman finally does meet her father, he's a painter, as you said. I think you saw a painting that inspired you here in Berlin, but this, The Valley of Amazement, is the name of one of his paintings. This sort of, well, describe it for us, how you picture the painting that she gazed upon, this wonderful work by her father.
Well, the painting is one I saw in Berlin at the National Gallery, and it was a valley and mountains on the side, but it also appeared to have a storm either brewing or leaving. Big clouds, shots of light, and it seemed to be either dawn or dusk. It was hard to determine. There was that ambiguity that was very uncomfortable. And there was a figure, and I couldn't tell whether the figure was supposed to be leaving or arriving, whether you were arriving with hope or dread, or whether you were leaving with relief or despair. And that is the sense. It's more the sense of the painting than the actual painting itself, the mm-hmm. details. It's an illusion. It's the thing that we are moving toward. And I think that's a metaphor. Whether you're moving toward America from another country, you have it's a mirage, an illusion. And part of it can be there, but it can evaporate as well.
You have Violet saying, asking, was the painting meant to depict a feeling of hope or was it hopelessness?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the American immigration story is always supposed to be, you know, about hope. But then her mother, as she's sailing off to Shanghai or later, she's thinking about it, she says, I had let infatuation guide me toward a golden veil that did not exist, toward a city at the other end of the sea. But she sees it as a golden veil that did not exist. I mean, hope, hopelessness.
Her salvation.
Yeah, that wasn't there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think so much about, you know, seas, oceans, shores, waters, as being that great divide, or the transport, the means in which you're going to arrive at something that you've always hoped for, you know, something that will save you.
But the Chinese thought the same way. Yeah. Coming to the U.S., yeah. Old Gold Mountain, yeah, Gaogansam, yeah. And all that.
Yeah.
Was her? I guess I'm asking: Have you come to see all this hope of salvation out there somewhere as misplaced?
Not necessarily. You know, in my family, there were people who left China for various reasons. My mother escaped a terrible marriage, but also she left on the eve of the communists taking over that country and knew that she would not be treated well because of her background. My father left for an education a couple of years earlier, and he found that it wasn't, you know, the wealth that maybe some dreamed of. My uncle's family, with our family's help, left, and they had a very hard time. And all of their children have become very, very successful. So some of them have found that it wasn't an illusion. It wasn't a mirage that disappeared. It was that hope, and they fulfilled that.
Let's go to our callers for you. Newport News, Virginia. Ashley is calling. Ashley, you're on the air with Amy Tan. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Amy. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to go back to what you were talking earlier about, Amy, about the self-hatred that you experienced growing up. I feel mm-hmm. like I experienced that a little later because, you know, I went to an all-Catholic school and, you know, I felt really like almost like protected. I didn't really experience racism. And it wasn't until after, you know, after I graduated from college, and I came out as a lesbian, like, I started to experience all these self-doubts and self-hatred, and I was just wondering, how did you cope with that, even when you were younger?
One of the lessons I learned, when I was in high school, I blamed my race for making me ugly. I thought I was ugly. Boys did not ask me out. And then one year, my father and brother died when I was 16, and we moved to Switzerland. My mother went a little crazy, and, you know, she wanted to escape the world. But in Switzerland, in Europe, I suddenly became exotic. I was beautiful. I had all of these men after me, not in a good way. But I realized at that age that my self-esteem and the way I saw myself could be jerked around depending on how people looked on me and their opinion of me. And my mother all along had been saying, you cannot let people judge you and let that be how you think of yourself. It's very hard. I mean, I say this in a facile way, but it is something I return to, that no matter what happens. It's something I had to remind myself of when my book became a bestseller, that it works the other way. Just mm-hmm. because you're in this other position, you shouldn't think of yourself as any better, you know, just because people's opinions are better.
Have you managed to find a spot beyond judgment?
Well, I think we're often buffeted buffeted by opinion.
I like to know where that
we're
is.
We're human.
Yeah.
You know, but in the dark of the night, you can remind yourself that who you are has always been the same, and you have to find a way to, you know, not let condescension, not let people's prejudices bring you down to the level that they are, you know, where they're perceiving you.
Even across lines of immigration, race, identity. Ashley, thanks for that call. Laura in Nashville, Tennessee. Laura, you're on with Amy Tan.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Amy. This conversation is fascinating. I'm calling because I've lived in Middle Tennessee for several years and come to know our beautiful Latino immigrant community here and worked on their behalf. Amy, what would you say to U.S. policymakers in regard to immigration reform and the conversations in Washington and their decisions about legislation, particularly as it pertains to undocumented immigrants?
I think we need more stories out there of immigrants who have been waiting and who can contribute so much to our country. You know, so much of what's going on in immigration to me is politics. and who can appeal to whom, and, you know, this whole idea of protecting our borders, protecting our jobs. I'll tell you that I would have been one of those kids, Dream Act kids. My parents came here on student visas, and their visas ran out. And today, they would have been facing deportation. And, you know, we kids might have also been facing that. Back in those days, however, we were born in the United States, and that wasn't an issue for the kids. But, you know, you look at people's perceptions of what immigration means. It's so one-sided. You know, the people who are against it look at illegal immigrants as criminals, people who take advantage of the system. That is not how I have seen anyone who has wanted to immigrate. There's a young woman I know, and she has, it's the level below her, a green card, but she's permitted to be here. Mm-hmm. And she's in college. She's about to finish. And she said, I sit there and I'm so angry when I see these people. They're on their texting on their phones and they're talking about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. They have no interest in it. And she said, I am reading this and I think this is what I want. This is why I want to be in this country. And, you know, I think we need more testimony like that. These are people who are here for all the reasons our country was founded.
Jennifer in Williamsburg, Virginia, you're on with Amy.
Yes, hi, Tom, and hi, Amy. I really appreciate your work, Amy, simply because I spent 3 years in China teaching English to university students, and they were from the countryside. And I loved them, and they were just so dear to me. And all the things you're talking about, whether it's stateside or in China, it just also seems that it's what a mother wants to pass on to her daughter, and making those careful decisions and not knowing whether that information is going to spoil the life of the future of their daughter or whether that's going to help, and that must be a huge risk when they choose to pass on certain types of information. I just was wondering if you could comment on that.
Oh, it's a great question. The way that parental advice, even stories, are so loaded. You pass them along and you know they may detonate over many years. They may have huge consequences, what you say, Amy.
Yeah. My mother was very protective. And because she had a bad marriage that I did not know about through my teens, she was always warning me about men and how they'll betray you and make you crazy and you'll want to... Here's her birth control advice. She said, don't let a boy kiss you, because if you do, maybe you can't stop. And then you're going to have a baby, and then you're going to be so ashamed, you're going to put the baby in the garbage can, then the police going to come, take you away to jail, rest of your life. You want to kiss a boy, kill yourself right now.
Oh.
You know, I'm thinking, whoa... My reaction, though, was, what's so good? You can't stop.
Yeah.
You know, so you could have
forget
this
all the rest.
Opposite reaction, you know, in my mind. Well, I'll go find this thing, but I'll know how to stop. You know, I'm strong enough. She's wrong.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah,
parental advice can be strong, but it can also be walked right past by kids.
Yeah,
It can work both ways. Yeah. I want to ask you about China, now that it's becoming so big, so rich, so powerful, and this country that you know so well, how's this going to work out? What's your big picture take on there's the whole world out there, but let's just take the United States and China. How does this relationship play out in the century of China's great power rise?
Well, I'm not an expert in foreign policy, but
cultures.
I think what we're finding is that Shanghai, China, many parts of Shanghai, the urban areas, are becoming like the Shanghai of the 1920s, very international, very modern. Some of the most modern hotels and facilities I've seen are in China. But there's an old side of it as well, which out in the country, the poverty is still there. And when we look at what's going on in terms of trade and debt to China, you know, I think there's always some uncertainty because the government is always, they could change their minds very quickly. They could suddenly become very sensitive to a policy or a reaction from a foreign country. They have not forgotten what happened. You know, we say, oh, what happened with the anti, you know, the foreigners years ago, the Boxer Rebellion, mm-hmm. you know, and all of that. That was long ago. Why haven't they forgotten? Well, they haven't. And they are very aware and wary of that. And you also look at a country like that, so powerful, so much of the economy of the world is leaning that way. And when you have a huge population that's still impoverished and one that is growing very fast and that has now problems with corruption, you wonder about the stability of that country you're depending on financially for your business. That's my take on it. You know, I'm not an expert on foreign policy, but I feel these things and I talk to people and I feel they are a little bit more uncertain, that the ground is moving a little bit underneath them. And I've heard of expats over there have been doing business for a long time who are thinking about leaving.
Chinese thinking about going back from the United States?
Oh, they're American. They're, you know, they're white Americans.
Oh, no, I mean the other, the Americans leaving China, but what, Chinese Americans who think about returning?
China-born people moving back to China because the opportunities are so great. You can become a millionaire much more quickly there than you can here.
Opportunity has magnetism. Amy Tan, it's always great to read you, to talk with you. The new book is The Valley of Amazement. There's an excerpt at our website. Amy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Amy Tan, The Valley of Amazement. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.